Third case for argument this morning is Contilli against the Teamsters Pension Fund. Mr. Boutwell.
Good morning. Charles Boutwell for Plaintiff Appellant. May it please the Court. This is a very large, important financial issue for the country as a whole. This is the first time in the 31 years since the enactment of ERISA that a case has held that benefits may be retroactively or may be forfeited under 29 1053A. This is the only source of authority. The plan says the benefits under a defined benefit plan commence on the later of attainment of normal retirement age or the pension application. Now, in that instance where the pension application is after the normal retirement age under this plan, the benefits are forfeited forever. Mr. Contilli, the court found that the pension application was filed on January 15, 1998. Contilli had claimed a benefit retroactive to January 1, 1998. The claims committee denied that because the pension application was untimely filed. There, Contilli forever forfeited $2,600, maybe $43 of pension benefits for that month. Now, when I joined the case, Contilli appealed pro se administratively. I saw that he was entitled to benefits back to November 1, 1997. He quit work in October of 1997, and after he quit work, he was entitled to his pension benefits. He was age 67, had 42 years of service, no question about his vesting. So Contilli really forfeited around $7,600 of pension benefits forever. There was no actuarial increase.
Is there some language in ERISA that you're relying on for the proposition that an application requirement is the same as forfeiture?
The
reason why I'm asking is that normally one thinks of forfeiture as something you can do that will lose your entitlement to benefits, as in being fired, the old bad boy clause. The ERISA obviously got rid of bad boy clauses. But the requirement that one apply for benefits, and they're given prospectively from application, is something you see in the Social Security system and almost every insurance policy one can imagine. But why would one think of this as a forfeiture under ERISA? Is there
in 1053A, it doesn't specifically mention late pension benefit applications. It says benefits may not be forfeited for any reason unless there are specific statutory reasons, and the only reasons, statutory reasons, are death and continued employment.
That's fine, but what I'm looking for is why you think that an application requirement and prospective benefits is a form of forfeiture.
Contilli forever loses those benefits.
I take it that if he got a check and he burned it, he would lose those benefits too, but we wouldn't view that as forfeiture. Is there a statutory definition in ERISA of forfeiture?
Let's see.
What would help me is either a definition in the statute or a definition in the Department of Labor regulations, or perhaps some history, some understanding of the way the word forfeiture has worked in the world of pension benefits at the time ERISA was enacted.
I think the generally understood term is that you lose benefits. There are situations where people don't apply for decades, and should they lose their benefits because they didn't have knowledge?
Could I just interrupt for a moment? Because I this is something that I was, you know, thinking a lot about, too. And I thought that the issue of whether the pension plan violates 29 U.S.C. 1053A's non-forfeitability provision is a very close one. I was troubled by the plan's eligibility provision. That pension plan, section 4.1, that ties the pension payment to the date an employee applies for benefits. But I wondered if it was ultimately defensible under 29 U.S.C. section 1053 and the Supreme Court's interpretation of it. And because he didn't apply for benefits until January 1998, he lost the benefit of the actuarial adjustment on his pension from October 1997 through February 98 when his benefits began paying out. But I'm wondering if he forfeited his retirement benefits as prohibited by 29 U.S.C. 1053A. You know, when you look at a lessee, that's a 1981 Supreme Court case, forfeiture ordinarily refers to a total loss in consequence of some event rather than a limit on the value of a person's rights. And here the pension fund delayed the commencement of the benefit until a retiree applies. And such a delay, it seems to me, doesn't amount to the forfeiture of the benefit. Instead, it impacts the interest accrued on the benefit and the number of payments made over his lifetime. So I know that that conclusion is in tension with several of the cases that you've cited from the Fourth and Ninth Circuit, which interpret similar plan language to allow retroactive claims, despite plan language that ties payment to the filing of an application for benefits. So, I mean, I'm terribly interested on what both parties have to say about whether he was adequately informed of the need to apply for benefits immediately upon retirement.
Well,
I hope that makes some sense to everyone.
Well, first, I might say ELEXI requires that a participant be entitled to 100% of his benefit, not and can't forfeit any portion of it. Because if you can begin forfeiting a portion of one's vested accrued benefit, employers are going to immediately take advantage of that. To date, there's been no case allowing any forfeiture on the basis of a late retirement application date. So this would be a case of first impression. All the cases say you cannot do it, and they do it on the basis of eligibility, saying it's an abuse of discretion based on eligibility. I suspect this is because there's a MIRA provision under the Internal Revenue Code, and they do not want to disqualify the plan.
What do you mean all the cases go the other way?
Well, the only cases I found were cited in the brief. There are no cases saying a pension plan may have an application date forfeit benefits based on a pension application date after the normal retirement date. None.
Are there any cases on that question at all? No. The principal case that your brief relies on, Bayard, construes the terms of a particular plan. It does not say that if the plan says X, then that's a forfeiture. Are there any cases on what the definition of a forfeiture is with respect to a non-retroactivity rule in a plan?
I don't believe so. I believe it uses the forfeiture term forfeiture. It uses the common sense understanding if you lose something.
Why, by the way, are you not making the argument that was made in Baird? Instead of saying this construction violates ERISA because it's a forfeiture, why aren't you saying that the plan misinterpreted its own language? I don't understand your brief to be saying that, so I'm puzzled.
First, if it's a question of statutory interpretation, there's de novo review of that. It's an issue of law. And a question of interpretation of the plan language, that also is an issue of law, but that might come under a different standard of review. I argued in both sides, but I would primarily rely that this is an issue of statutory interpretation because it is an issue of law requiring de novo review. A plan cannot determine whether it complies with ERISA. Moving on to the issue of the COBRA notice, Popovich clearly requires the COBRA notice to be accurate under 29 U.S.C. 1066. Contilli did not receive an accurate COBRA notice. It dramatically overstated the health insurance premium Contilli had to pay because Contilli continued to work, and he received credit for his premium payments under the plan, but he did not receive this credit and was not told about this credit. And he asked for the employer contribution history and was denied that history. There's an affidavit by Mr. Witt, the plan administrator, which lays it all out. It's clear that the premium Contilli owed was substantially less than the COBRA notice. These facts are uncontested. I believe the COBRA notice was invalid under the Milsner case, Seventh Circuit case. It's clear that the understandings of Contilli do not apply here. He has to receive an accurate COBRA notice.
Before we leave this forfeiture question forever,
okay.
Did you try to find whether the Department of Labor has issued a regulation defining forfeiture under ERISA?
Yes, I don't believe it has.
So you don't think there's one out there? Okay.
I know that the IRS has requested language that the benefits be non-forfeitable for any reason. I think that covers it.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Did the COBRA notice that he received explain anywhere that his premiums would be offset by employer contributions?
It may have referred to that. I don't recall exactly, but it didn't give the amounts, and Contilli asked for the employer contribution history. It was denied. It was not clear. I believe you have to lay it down in a COBRA notice. What premium do you have to pay?
Maybe I'm very simplistic, but how would the health plan know prospectively in November of 96 when it sent the COBRA notice whether Contilli would receive employer contributions that would reduce his payment obligation for continued coverage?
These contributions were received in September and October. Contilli worked through October of 1997 and quit work. He worked in September, October, and November. So the plan had that information available at the time it sent the COBRA notice out. It should have. Contilli submitted his 32s.
They say they didn't. Don't they?
They say they didn't receive contributions, but Contilli submitted his W-2 slips proving he received it, and they should have known. They should have known because he was working for a covered employer, and then they denied this history encapsulation to him, so he couldn't correct the record.
How do you explain your argument that if he received an inadequate COBRA notice, he's automatically covered under the health plan and entitled to sick list, time, pension credit, dental benefits? Even if the notice was inadequate, he still would be required to pay his portion for coverage, wouldn't he?
I believe you can offset that. There are some cases that don't require the offset. He could retroactively pay the premium payments and so forth. But he should be able, given that option, to at least retroactively pay the premium payments, which was Propovitz. There are other cases saying you don't have to pay it, but I would go along with Propovitz to pay the premiums.
Did the COBRA notice that he received explain anywhere that his premiums would be offset by employer contributions?
It may have alluded to that fact, and it's also in the summary plan description, but it didn't tell the amounts. The COBRA notice is etched in stone. It's the November 14th, 1997 letter to Contilli. But the specific amounts were not given. Contilli requested those amounts and was not given that. The plan denied that information to Contilli.
And
you should look at the Milsner case. It says even though Contilli claimed the benefits under the $225 a week and the dental benefits, Milsner says you don't even have to claim benefits if the COBRA notice is invalid.
Well, I mean, maybe your friend Mr. Ryan can explain why when he requested his contribution history the same month that he received the continuation of benefit selection that the plan administrator denied his request.
We didn't get the contribution history until discovery in the litigation.
I understand this. So, I mean, I don't see how he could be faulted for appealing the notice, because it seems to me, at any rate, it's the plan's obligation to give him accurate information, but that maybe you'll help me.
And Mills knows, Seventh Circuit case, so holds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Boutwell. Mr. Ryan.
May it please the Court. My name is Patrick Ryan, and I'm representing the Appalese Local 705 International Brotherhood of Teamsters Pension and Health and Welfare Funds. Of course, the welfare and pension funds are multi-employer plans governed by ERISA, serving truck drivers working in the Chicago area. And one of their participants, the pension fund participants, is Mr. Cantilli, who has been receiving a pension benefit since February 1998. Mr. Cantilli was also a beneficiary of the welfare fund through October 1996.
Okay, so did the health plan administrator give any reason for denying Mr. Cantilli's request for the history of employer contributions made on his behalf? I mean, is such a denial standard?
At the time it was, Your Honor. I can't speak as to what the policy is now, but generally ERISA specifies what documents a plan is required to turn over to participants or employers. And
so if that's the case, there couldn't have been any process in place, it seems to me, under which he could have disputed the COBRA notice that he received. I mean, does the notice itself provide any procedure for questioning the information it contains?
I don't believe the notice did say anything about that, Your Honor.
You know, this is so Alice in Wonderland that I feel like screaming, but I won't.
I think that we might be able to resolve the COBRA issue on more procedural, mundane matters, Your Honor, just by virtue of the fact that the district court held that Mr. Cantilli waived his COBRA argument by failing to plead it in his complaint.
Why would the burden to dispute the validity of a COBRA notice be on an employee? Isn't the purpose of the notice based on the principle that the employee generally won't know how to continue coverage?
I think that there is no – you're correct, Your Honor. The burden is not on the participant to show that the COBRA notice is invalid through an administrative appeal, but we didn't even have a basis to believe that that was a claim in this complaint, and that's what the district court held on this issue.
Well, what notice did he receive from the pension plan informing him of his eligibility to collect benefits in October of 97? Was the plan provision using the later of the normal retirement date or the employee's application date explained anywhere other than in Section 4.1 of that pension plan?
As far as the pension claim, Your Honor, unfortunately the record is silent as to any other notices that might have been tendered to Mr. Cantilli about his pension rights and what he needed to apply. Again, ERISA requires certain documents to be disclosed, such as a summary plan description, and there's no issue in this case about whether he received the notices required by ERISA. But as to whether there were other notices given at the time Mr. Cantilli retired in October, it's just not in the record.
Well, does the pension plan specifically force or forbid retroactive benefits? Or is Section 4.1 providing for payments to begin on the later of the employee's retirement or his application for benefits the only provision on the subject?
In Section 4.9 of the plan, Your Honor.
4.9, did you say?
Yes, Your Honor, 4.9B. There is a provision stating that no election of benefits shall be deemed valid until an application is received and such election has been made, and no payment and no election shall be effective retroactively unless otherwise required by law. So there is the provision prohibiting a retroactive payment, which would distinguish this case from most of those relied upon by Mr. Cantilli.
So then we circle right. May I just finish the one thought? So then we just circle right back to there no reason given denying his request for the history of employer contributions. We circle right back. I mean, this is so circular.
Well, there is a difference that I'd like to point out, Your Honor. The request that he made for his eligibility information, I believe, was a request to the welfare fund, if I'm remembering right. And now we're looking at pension benefits, and they are two distinct funds. The welfare fund handles the health benefits exclusively, and the pension fund the pension benefits. So I guess I would want to make that distinction.
I think you have to be a PhD in ERISA to be able to figure this whole thing out.
Your Honor, this is a very complicated case. I think the facts, and frankly, confuse me quite often. So if I misspeak as to any of them, I do apologize. But and part of the problem is the length of time that has gone by since all this happened. You know, the pension fund began paying Mr. Cantillo's benefits back in February of 98. He appealed it later at the end of 98, asking for a start date of January. That was heard in February and denied. And then 6 years later is when this lawsuit was filed, where he first then requested the additional 2 months of pension benefits.
Mr. Ryan, as I read through all of these papers, one question kept coming to me, and perhaps you can enlighten me. Why would the pension fund have this rule about not paying benefits retroactively?
Your Honor, I could only speculate as to the reason. You know, obviously the trustees, when they enact terms of the plan, do what they think is best for all of the participants and not just one. I don't know that this is still the case, but at the time, just in the trustees' best judgment, they believed that a retroactive payment would not be in the best interest of the plan.
It's a fixed benefit. I mean, that's not going to change. It's pretty easy to, when the man reaches his retirement date, you know what you owe.
That's true, Your Honor.
Whether he applied for it in November, he applied for it in January, you know what you owe him. Nobody else in the plan gets hurt. And that's why I just couldn't understand why the plan was making the point so energetically that you can't have retroactive payments. It doesn't hurt anybody.
Well, I think you make a good point about knowing, obviously, that Mr. Cantilli was over 65 at the time he retired. I mean, those type of facts don't change. Unfortunately, you know, when the plan was enacted as to why that provision was included, I just can't say. I think that...
Do you know whether provisions like this are normal? I mean, one could imagine a pension plan being worried about somebody waiting several years after his retirement date until he knows more about his own health, and then choosing either the normal retirement date, which is advantageous if you think you're going to die soon, or the age 70 retirement date, which is advantageous if you think you're going to live for a while, so that you would try to beat the actuarial odds. But whether that's a serious problem is something I suppose we could learn from the experience of the industry as a whole. What do we know about that?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, the record doesn't have information on that either.
This is not something you find in records of cases. That is, if you go and look, there's a huge finance literature about the operation of the pension industry. If you go and look at the scholarly literature, one could find out, I am sure, what percentage of pension plans have rules like this, and of plans that don't, what percentage of them have, you know, what percentage of claims appears to be opportunistic. You wait for a while and then make a claim based on health information that's private to you and not known to the plan.
Right.
One could find this out, but I take it what you're saying is you've never tried to find this out.
I have not, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I think the court pointed out the Alessi versus Rebestos case, which I think does support the plan's position that the benefits that are offered are really up to the plan sponsors, and ERISA does not require any specific benefits. But there's just nothing in ERISA that specifically says that a plan cannot have a provision prohibiting or requiring the application and then prohibiting retroactive payment prior to the date of the application. This is a uniformly applied rule, as the district court found. There's no evidence that the fund applied this rule inconsistently to Mr. Cantilli. Accordingly, as the district court explained it, whatever rights Mr. Cantilli had to his benefits at the time he applied were not forfeited. However, when he chose to apply, did in fact affect the benefits that he received, but he was not treated any differently from other employees. Mr. Cantilli could have applied in October 1997 and began receiving his benefit in November 1997, but did not do so, and we just don't know the reason why for that. Let me switch briefly back to the welfare issue. The The district court held that the trustees did not act arbitrary and capriciously when they found that his coverage with the welfare fund terminated in October 1996. Mr. Cantilli did not appeal this issue directly. Accordingly, we believe that that issue is forfeited and that the district court's decision stands. But even looking at that issue...
But how could he appeal the notice when he wasn't given any information? He certainly wasn't given any accurate information.
Not so much that he appealed the COBRA notice. I understand the court's position that it would be hard to appeal a COBRA notice without having additional information. But just through the context of this case on the district court level, the district court found that the trustee's decision was reasonable, that his coverage terminated in October 1996.
But the district court did that by placing the burden on Cantilli of informing the plan that the amounts in the COBRA notice were incorrect. And it seems to me that that just misses the point of the statutorily required notice.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I would disagree. I don't think the district court is putting the burden on Mr. Cantilli to challenge the COBRA notice with the trustees necessarily. I think the key holding by the district court as to the COBRA issue is that it was waived because it was not in his complaint. Whether he was able to contest it...
Here's what the district court said. The district court erred. I thought it erred by concluding that Cantilli waived the issue of inadequate notice by failing to tell the trustees, and now I quote, that their amount was incorrect. And that's the district court opinion at 6. So that certainly puts the burden on Cantilli of informing the plan that the amounts in the COBRA notice were incorrect.
I do see that, Your Honor, and you're right. The district court did hold that he waived it by failing to appeal it to the trustees, but the district court then went further at the very end of that paragraph. This claim is waived. It was not appealed and does not seem to appear in the complaint here, and I think that is the more important part for purposes of this appeal. But looking at the COBRA claim on its merits, too, Your Honor, based on the record developed on summary judgment, I think it's clear that Mr. Cantilli did receive adequate COBRA notice here. The case primarily relied upon Popovitz is distinguishable. In that case, we had an employee who was terminated, initially not given COBRA coverage. Later on, the employer decided that she should receive COBRA coverage. She elected 7 months, but then was purportedly billed for 18. This court then remanded, saying that billing for an amount of time in excess of that requested by the participant would be a violation of the COBRA notice and required additional factual findings from the district court. In this case, the notice sent out by the fund told Mr. Cantilli the amount he would have to pay on a monthly basis to continue his coverage on a month-by-month basis. And there's no indication in the record that Mr. Cantilli ever elected any coverage. The facts that were elicited don't give any basis to believe that the trustees knew that Mr. Cantilli was working in October and November 1996. He was laid off from his employer in September of 96, which was the basis for the COBRA notice being generated. Mr. Cantilli is contending that the trustees somehow knew that he was working in October and November, and that's just not factually possible. The employers contribute on a monthly basis. Technically, they're due by the 10th of the month following the month when the work was done, but they're given until the end of the month. So if we look at just October, the trustees wouldn't know where he worked in October until mid to the end of November. So by the time they're generating a notice on November 14th, all they know is that he was laid off in September. They have no way of knowing that he was working for another contributing employer. It was only later on that the funds received either contribution reports from the employers or check stubs from Mr. Cantilli showing that he worked.
But if they had furnished his contribution history to him, perhaps he could have enlightened them. You know, in December 1996, for example, he actually only owed $98 to continue coverage, but he receives this notice that reports the amount owing to be $656, and they won't furnish his contribution history. And he doesn't get it until it's produced on, in discovery, he has to go to district court.
Your Honor, I do understand those concerns, but the trustees didn't just slam the door in Mr. Cantilli's face. The administrator did say, look, go get your Social Security earnings, come in, sit down with us, we're happy to go over them and make sure that you get all the credit you want. The fact that they don't turn over their computer records, which is not required by ERISA, doesn't mean that they are being dismissive of Mr. Cantilli's concerns. The trustees have always been willing to sit down. They've addressed the numerous letters coming from Mr. Cantilli over the past 10-plus years, and, Your Honor, I see my time is up.
You know, it seems to me, and perhaps I'm just, musing, but it seems to me that if the trustees would hand over this information, not just to Mr. Cantilli, but hand it over, our burden would be about 10% less in the courts. I mean, here we are at a terrible loss, and it's because things that people ought to be getting are impossible to get. And it just seems foolish. I mean, it's not your fault.
Suppose you lose on the welfare issue. What would the appropriate remedy be?
I think if the court were to reverse on the welfare issue, that I think the case law does support that he would be entitled to coverage for the time he retired, but he would have to pay the premiums. So where that would leave us, whether that would result...
He retired until...
He retired in October of 97, so it would have been a period of November 96 through October of 97. Neither of the parties have done the math as to what that would work out to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Anything further, Mr. Batwell? You have
seconds. I can correct. The cover notice did not refer to the premiums. The complaint didn't contain the 1066 allegation because we didn't have any information at the time of the complaint. A leasee requires 100% of the benefits, that there be a legally enforceable right to 100% of the accrued benefit, not just a portion of it. Cantilli was unmarried, so Judge Easterbrook's good point on possibly trying to select adversely would not be a question in this case. As unmarried, he could not.
You know the answer to my question, however. That is, how do other pension funds handle this problem? And of those that don't have an anti-retroactivity rule, what's been their experience?
I drafted plans for many, many years, over 1,000 plans at least. I never put a provision like this in. I almost never saw it. I think it's there to try to chintz on the benefits to save cost of the pension plan, to snare an unsuspecting widow who may apply 10 years late and forever lose her pension. It snares the people unaware of their pension benefits.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay.